Thanks, Mark. Okay, we are in the book of Joel. So as we continue through our study of the kind of overview of the minor prophets, we come to a book that's a little bit shorter. Hosea was 14 chapters long, and definitely longer than, say, the major prophet of, or the book that we classify major prophets of Lamentations, or even Daniel. But Joel is short. It's three chapters long. And as I was putting this study together, Emily said, "Didn't you? I'm pretty sure you've given a lesson on the book of Joel." And she's right. It's kind of a funny thing. When I was a member at Prince Road, we did an overview of a book every, I think it was Sunday evening. If you were on for the Sunday evening sermon, then you were responsible to give the overview of the book. And we did that for, 66 weeks, so a little over a year. And I got Leviticus, and then the next time I was up, I got the book of Joel. And I thought I would do something, unique and different. And so I wrote my sermon in my Bible for that book. Dwayne, you did this before where you had those, here's your starting point, and you go from here to here to here. Well, I kind of had done that with the lesson. It worked well when you were, 21. So I pulled out my old Bible and I'm like, oh yeah, well, I don't remember what I was thinking here. So, because you can't write the whole thing in the margin. So, I brought my other Bible with me in case we get sidetracked on something. All right, so as we look at the book of Joel, let's kind of start with the who, right? Who was the prophet and who was the recipient? The prophet, it's the book of Joel. So Joel, we know, is the prophet. What do we know about Joel? All right, we know who his dad was. We don't know who his dad was. Dwayne, you pretty much covered it, right? That's it. That's all we know about Joel. We know who his father was. The name Joel means Yahweh is God, or Jehovah is God. There's some other individuals in the Bible who are named Joel. Most notably is the oldest son of Samuel. We know for sure, right, that it's not those two guys aren't the same, right? Because Pethuel is not Samuel, right? In fact, most of the Joels that we have listed in the Bible, we know who their fathers are. And then the other thing is Samuel's son was not righteous. And so we know that it's not him. So we really don't know anything about Joel. We sort of know who he wrote to, although it's not explicit. The book appears to be written to the southern kingdom, to Judah. And the reason I say that is because of some of the commands that are listed in the book. So if you look at chapter 2 and verse 1, and you look at chapter 2 and verse 15, there's a command there to blow the trumpet in Zion, which would be Jerusalem. Now, is that figurative or is that literal? I don't know. Looking at verse chapter 2, verse 32 through 3 and 1. And we'll actually spend a little bit of time on this group of passages, but I'll just read it for right now. Chapter 2, 32. "And it shall come to pass that whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there shall be deliverance, as the Lord has said, among the remnant who the Lord calls. For behold, in those days and at that time I will bring back the captives of Judah and Jerusalem." So I kind of think that this is written to the nation of Judah. There's some other contextual things that make me think that. Any other dispute or issues with that?
Well, if you go ahead, you're probably going to do Amos next. I don't know.
Yeah.
They're pretty well connected, but Amos is definitely to the northern kingdom.
And yeah.
It seems like Joel is to the southern.
To the southern, yeah.
Just a really rough time frame of when he lived, just because of what he prophesied about.
Yeah, so that's actually the next topic, is when did he prophesy? Well, Mike, what do you think? Because there's nothing in the book that inherently tells us this is when it was written. Like, you know, when we went to Hosea, Hosea tells us exactly who was kings when he wrote. But Joel just starts in, and there's no mention of any kings that are ruling. There is one mention of a king, sort of, and that's in chapter 3, verse 2. So in chapter 3, verse 2, we have a mention of a king, sort of, right? And I will also gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, right? Well, okay, so Jehoshaphat was a king, and so we know that. Well, one thing we know for sure is that the book of Joel was written after Jehoshaphat.
Well, also, he references Tyre and Sidon being evil. And also, it appears to me that this first army is the Assyrians coming from the north. And, of course, their army lasted for quite some time, but it's still, and I can't tell you what that time frame is, but we could look it up, so it would be within that time range of when they were taken away.
Yeah.
Because their army, God used their army to do that.
Yep. So,
around 830 BC.
Yeah, so, let's just jump into this, because it's interesting. It's an interesting conversation. So, dating the book of Joel is a little bit of a challenge in some regards, because there's nothing specific in the book that tells us, oh yeah, this is exactly when it was written. There aren't any kings mentioned. There's no real specific events that are mentioned that help us. There are some general things in the book that are of interest to us. First of all, there's no mention of idol worship in the book. And that becomes key to some people. Think about it for a minute. The children of Israel, when do we know that the children of Israel did not worship idols?
Did not worship idols
at any time in their history. Yeah, it's almost a tough question. We know for certain that they didn't worship idols after they came back from captivity, right? That's pretty much it, right? But we know, I say it this way. I don't think that it was written after the captivity. And the reason I think that is because of Joel chapter 3, verse 1. Because it says, for behold, in those days and at that time, sort of talking future language-wise, when I bring back the captives of Judah and Jerusalem. So I don't think this is post-exile. So was there a time prior to the captivity of Judah, but after Jehoshaphat, that the children of Israel didn't worship idols? And I think the answer is probably not. I couldn't find it. Now, there were times when the idol worship was sort of suppressed, and it wasn't a holistic worshiping of idols amongst the nation, but it's interesting. There's no mention of idol worship here.
Does that mean that just because he didn't mention it in three short chapters,
yeah, they weren't doing it? Yeah. No, it doesn't mention. It doesn't necessarily mean that. Yeah, particularly because of the overall theme that punishment, part of the theme that punishment is coming. You'd think he'd mention idolatry, but you're right, it's a short message.
I think probably was written before Amos wrote his, but there was something on his mind, and that was how the Sidonians and the Philistines had actually encouraged Syria, like Mike was saying, to come down.
Now, I have a little bit of a different perspective, but we'll get to it. But Dwayne's mentioned it twice, so there's nations mentioned in chapter 3, right? Tyre and Sidon, there's Greeks, Sabines, Egypt, Edom. Maybe this gives us some context. Temple worship is mentioned, and the temple is mentioned a couple of times. And the priesthood is mentioned. In fact, it's not routinely mentioned, but it's at least mentioned. So there are two general thoughts on when the book was written, an early writing and a late writing. Now, I'm of the belief that it's written early, and part of the reason I believe that is because of how it's grouped in the Bible. Part of it is just based on some of the contextual things. And the thought is that it's written, as Theda was saying, around the 830s, maybe around 836, during the reign of Joash or Jehoash. It's the same guy, Joash, Jehoash. And the reason is that it seems to explain why no king was mentioned, and some of the other general comments fit. So if you remember about Joash, Joash was anointed king when he was 7 years old. And the backstory there was that his grandmother was Athaliah. And if you remember who Athaliah was, she was the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. She married, now Ahab and Jezebel were from Israel, but Athaliah married Ahaziah, the king of Judah. And then, now Ahaziah had other wives and other children. And when Ahaziah died, Athaliah claimed the throne, and then she started to kill off all of Ahaziah's children. Both, and it sort of sounds like maybe even her own children, if she had her own children, but she certainly killed the children of the other wives. And anyone who could have claimed the throne, because it sounds like there was one of the family members, a female, who stole away Joash when he was just a year old and hid him. And then after 6 years, the priest, and his name was Jehoiada, he leads the people to anoint Joash as king. Athaliah is killed, and Joash is anointed king at 7 years old. Now, then the story there in 2 Kings just starts talking about the reign of Joash, but Jewish history says that at 7 years old, Joash wasn't really the ruling king. He was king, but Jehoiada was really the guy in charge, and he was sort of a caretaker of the kingdom. And so if Joel was prophesied during this caretaking period, it would sort of make sense that the priests are being mentioned, but that there isn't a king being mentioned, because Joash wasn't really leading the people. These nations, Phoenicia, Philistia, Egypt, Edom, all of them were prominent during this 9th century. And if it's correct that it's prophesied during this time period, then Joel would have been contemporary with Elisha. And so kind of gives you some time frame as to what's going on. Another thought is that it was written later, that it was written maybe post-exile, but not yet to when all of the people had returned, when Zerubbabel was leading the people. Now, that sort of makes sense too, right? Because was Zerubbabel a king? No, he really wasn't a king. He was sort of a governor of sorts. And so the challenge here with that is that, the reason why people look at that is because of what's mentioned in chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, where it sort of gives the idea that maybe Israel, the nation of Israel, is already scattered and that Judah is in captivity already. I'll just read that. For behold, in those days and at that time, when I bring back the captives of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations, and I will bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. I will enter into judgment with them there on account of my people, my heritage, Israel, whom they have scattered amongst the nations. They will also divide up my land. So some people look at this and say, all right, so the children of Israel have, Israel, the nation, has been scattered, but Judah is in captivity, but yet hasn't fully been brought back. One other reason is in chapter 3, verse 6, there's this mention of the people being sold to the Greeks. And about this same time period, there was a guy named Ptolemy Soter, who was a Greek general who was conquering. He was part of, I believe he was worked with Alexander. And Josephus says that they sold a bunch of Israelites to the Greeks. So some people look at that and say, yeah, it's a later date. In the end, I don't know that it really matters. If it's a later date, then he's contemporary with Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. I sort of think it's an earlier date. And that makes sense because then it really is prophetic. Any other comments about that? I know it's a little tedious.
I have him down as contemporary with Isaiah, Amos, Hosea, and Micah.
Hmm. And yeah, that 8:30 time frame, yeah. Isaiah seems to be contemporary with a lot of prophets because he prophesied for so long. All right, so let's talk about the themes of the book. We'll spend the most of our time here. Kind of the overall theme of the book is this progression of a coming punishment of God's people, a call for repentance, future salvation of God's people, and then coming punishment for the enemies of God's people. That's sort of the overall theme. But if you had to choose one phrase for the theme of the book of Joel, what do you think it would be?
Day of the Lord.
I think that's right. Now, people who look at Joel being written early will say that Joel was the first person to prophesy about the day of the Lord, and that all the other prophets that reference the day of the Lord are sort of referencing Joel. And it's an interesting study if you go and look at all of the other minor prophets, and even Isaiah and Jeremiah, that there are components of their prophecies that seem to match with some of the things that Joel is saying. Now, I think that's probably just God working through the prophets to give the same kind of message. Some people will look at that and say, well, they knew about Joel's prophecy. But I agree. The theme, the overall theme, if you had to put it in one phrase, is Day of the Lord. It's first mentioned in chapter 1 and verse 15. Alas for the day, for the day of the Lord is at hand, it shall come as destruction from the Almighty. It's the first time it's mentioned. And it's mentioned probably six times in total. So let's just read those. So there's 1 and 15. Somebody read chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. So this is the next mention of the day of the Lord. All right. The next one is chapter 2, verse 11. So let me read that for us. And while we're reading these, the next question, we're done reading them, the next question I'm going to ask is, what do we know from Joel's prophecy about the day of the Lord? Okay, so chapter 2, verse 11.
The Lord gives his voice before his army, for his camp is very great. For strong is the one who executes his word, for the day of the Lord is great and very terrible.
All right. Verse 31 in chapter 2.
The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord.
Chapter 3, verses 14 through 16.
Multitudes in the valley of decision. For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon will grow dark and the stars will diminish their brightness. You said verse 16.
Yep.
The Lord also will roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. The heavens and the earth will shake, but the Lord will be a shelter for his people and the strength of the children of Israel.
Okay. And then the last one is verse 18, 3 and 18.
And it will come to pass in that day that the mountains will drip new wine. The hills shall flow with milk, and all the brooks of Judah will be flooded with water. The fountain shall flow from the house of the Lord and water the valley of the Acacias.
All right. So those are the six passages there in Joel that reference the day of the Lord. So after looking through those passages, what do we know about this day, or at least what's prophesied about this day? All right, yeah, there's a lot of things going to happen. What kinds of things do we know?
Great and
Yeah, so chapter 2, verse 11 says that the day of the Lord is going to be great and terrible. What else do we know? Okay, so 2 and 31 calls it awesome. All right, what else?
Darkness,
yeah. And actually, there's several of them that mention that. Darkness and gloom, 2 and then 2 and 31 also mentions that. Chapter 3 talks about that.
Miracles of nature was what that would be.
Yeah, so there's other things too, right? So chapter 3, verse 16 says that heavens and earth will shake. Now, again, we've got to ask ourselves, is this figurative or is this literal? We'll get to that. But what else do we know?
The mountains will drip with wine, the land will flow with milk, and the brooks of Judah will be flooded with water.
Yeah, so there's this message of blessing too, right? So there's this message of destruction, and there's this message of blessing. Interesting. What else do we know? All right, so 3 and 16, God's going to protect His people. All right, some other things I wrote. 1 and 15 and 2 and 1 give the idea that this day is near, right? It's coming. There's an expectancy happening. 2 and 15 says there'll be destruction. 2 and 1, how is this day going to be announced? With a trumpet. Yeah. Oh, okay. 2 and 1 says that people will tremble. 3 and 14, I really like verse 3 and 14. There's going to be multitudes there. And where is it going to be? Where's the day of the Lord going to be? In the valley of decision. Really interesting. Okay, so those are sort of the prophetic things we know about the day of the Lord. Well, when is the day of the Lord?
Well, I think that's the big thing about this book is Joel mixes prophecy of the return and things that's going to happen in their lifetime and also the end of time.
Yeah.
Especially chapter 2, verses 28 through 32, that a lot of people today take to justify miracles that they say they do,
yep,
in the religious world.
Yep. So, like so many prophecies, there's a meaning for the people who are hearing it that's a somewhat soon fulfillment, and then there's this future spiritual fulfillment of the prophecy as well. And the day of the Lord is the same thing, right? The day of the Lord really, it happens on a day that God executes His plan. So the day of the Lord was the day that the children of Israel were taken into captivity, right? That was the day of the Lord. Right? The day of the Lord was also, it will also be the day that Jesus comes back and judgment day happens. And so anytime God's plan is executed, it could be called the day of the Lord. But those are the two major ones, right? So it's interesting, right, that we could go and look at the day of the Lord that we are anticipating, the return of Jesus, and see many of those same things, right? What are we told about the day of the Lord? That it's coming, right? It's near. Well, near, I mean, it's been 2,000 years since that was said, but yet we also know that we need to prepare for it. It will be a day of destruction, right? How will Jesus be announced? With a trumpet, that's right. Will there be people who tremble? Absolutely. We're told that there will be folks who will want to have the mountains fall on them. Is it going to be dark and gloomy? Well, you know, it's interesting. That may actually be a prophecy about the death of Jesus. Because we know that at Jesus' death, if we were looking at what can we find in the book of Joel that prophesies about Jesus, people will look to that about the darkness and gloom. Was Jesus' death on the cross the day of the Lord? Well, I don't know that it's referenced that way, but I think certainly if somebody argued that, I wouldn't say that they're wrong. Is the end of time going to be great and terrible and awesome? Absolutely. But the thing that makes me think that the day of the Lord, Joel is mentioning, certainly is the end of time is chapter 3, verse 14. Multitudes and multitudes in the valley of decision. Isn't that, I don't know that I've ever heard the end of time judgment day be called the valley of decision, but that's really what it is, isn't it? All right. Any other comments about the day of the Lord?
My thought going through there was,
you can't miss it. That's exactly right. Yep. Yep. All right, I want to take a little bit of a sidetrack that I find really, really interesting about one of the other themes in the book. What's the animals mentioned in the book? Animals is the wrong word. It's an insect. But yeah, it's locusts. Yeah, so let's talk for a minute about locusts. Somebody read chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. All right. Well, this is how the book starts. So what do we know about the locusts?
They're hungry.
And they're coming. And what are they going to eat?
Everything.
And they're mentioned again, which we'll get to that here in a minute. But so here's this sort of prophecy about locusts, that the locusts are coming and they're going to eat everything. Now, is this literal or is this figurative? Yeah.
So I don't know. I think in Amos it talks about locusts, which is more physical, I think.
Yeah, it may be both, right? A lot of times prophecies are, there's some physical component and a spiritual component. There may have been a swarm of locusts that devoured the land after this prophecy. I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it referenced. But for sure, it's definitely figurative, right? In Joel...
They understood what locusts
were. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, skip over to chapter 1, verse 6 and 7. Someone read that for us, because here, this is a continuation of the prophecy, okay? But here we're told what the locusts represent.
For a nation has come up against my land, strong without number. His teeth are the teeth of the lion, and he has the fangs of a fierce lion. He's laid waste my vine and ruined my fig tree. He stripped it bare and thrown it away. His branches.
All right, so we know that it's figurative, and it's figurative to represent a nation, maybe nations. And so what do we know about the characteristics of this locust from these verses? Well, we know that they're strong, they're without number, and then something very interesting. What's the descriptive terms given there in verse 6? Yeah, they have teeth like lion's teeth. All right. Yeah, so now let's skip ahead to chapter 2. Chapter 2, verses 3 through 5. Now, I believe that we're continuing to talk about this locust, this nation or nations that are coming to destroy the children of Israel. So somebody read chapter 2, 3 through 5. All right.
I was about to ask you if the locust had any kind of reference to fire.
Yeah, and they do. There's a connection here, right? So in chapter 2, verse 3, it talks about them as a fire. And it's sort of, you know, the description in chapter 1 of them consuming everything. Well, what does a fire do? A fire consumes everything. So that may be why there's that connection there. But What do the locusts, or who do the locusts represent? Well, we know from chapter 1, verse 6, that they represent a nation. It may be nations. Some people actually think that the four major world powers that eventually will rule over the children of Israel are represented by the four stages of the locust there. The chewing locust, chewing, swarming, crawling, consuming locusts. Those four stages, that then it's those four, the Babylon, Medo-Persian, Greece, and Roman. I actually am of the thought that maybe what's being represented here is just the Babylonian Empire. And here's the reason why I think this. So in Joel chapter 2, verse 20, and I can't remember if it was Dwayne or Mike made reference to this, but here the army is mentioned specifically as being called the Northern Army. And I think you're right to say that the Northern Army could be Assyria, but Babylon is also referred to in the major prophets as being a Northern Army or coming from the north. And that's how they would have came. They would have, you know, circled around the desert and then come down from the north. And then another reason that may be connecting this to Babylon is in Daniel, his prophecy about those four great world powers, Babylon is mentioned first, and all of them are connected with animals, right? What was Babylon represented with? Do you remember? No? It's lion, right? So Daniel chapter 4, or chapter 7, verse 4, the first was like a lion and had eagle's wings, and I watched till its wings were plucked off and it was lifted from the earth. It was made to stand on 2 feet like a man and had a man's heart was given to it. So are we grasping at straws there? Maybe, right? But it has teeth like a lion's teeth, and then Babylon is represented by a lion with eagle's wings. Northern Army, yep. Yep.
Retreating or being
going back to Babylon. Yep. I bring up the locust for one reason. I think it's kind of an interesting study, and we're not going to get into too much detail in it. But one of the reasons why I wanted to look at the minor prophets is because the prophecies of the Old Testament help us to understand the prophecies in the New Testament. And where in the New Testament do we read of locusts? Well, John ate locusts, but in a prophetic way. Yeah, in Revelation, yeah. So I don't want to get into a study of Revelation, but I do want to go to Revelation chapter 9. All right, so as you're turning there, think of the things that we know about the locusts here in Joel. We know for certain that the locusts are representative of a nation or nations, and they're given these really interesting descriptions, right? It said that they're strong and without number. They have teeth like lion's teeth. They lay waste to everything. In chapter 2, it says that fire goes before them and a flame behind them. Their appearance is like horses, like swift steeds. The sound of them is like chariots. They go over mountaintops, like the noise of flaming fire. Right. So keeping all that in mind, now let's go to Revelation 9. Somebody read the first 11 verses there. Oh, go ahead.
Torment them for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. In those days, men will seek death and will not find it. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. The shape of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were crowns of something like gold, and their faces were like the faces of men. They had hair like women's hair, and their teeth were like lions' teeth. And they had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots with many horses running into battle. They had tails like scorpions, and there were stings in their tails. Their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had, as king over them, the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek he has the name Apollyon.
All right. Thanks, Eddie. That's really interesting, isn't it? Right? So you think about what's said there in Revelation about this locust, and you connect it to what is being mentioned in Joel. There's lots of similarities, right? There's this issue of how they look like horses, how they sound like horses. There's a connection to fire and smoke. There's just interesting things there. So knowing that Joel had prophesied about locusts and it was a nation and a people makes us understand that probably what's happening here in Revelation chapter 9 is that this isn't literally locusts that are going to come, that this is a nation. So, all right, we don't have a ton of time. I just wanted to whet your appetite with that. What are some key verses from the book of Joel? Well, I have two key verses, and the first is in Joel chapter 2, verse 12 and 13. Now therefore, says the Lord, turn to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping, and with mourning. So rend your hearts and not your garments. Return to the Lord your God, for He is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness. He relents from doing harm. This is sort of the turning point in the book, right? All the way up to verse 2 and 11 is all about destruction. And then verse 2 and 12 and 2 and 13, this is the beginning of this call to repentance, and God says, rend your heart and not your garments. And this is so true of the Old Testament, right? It reinforces what the real message of the Old Testament is, and that is that it's not the outer physical state, but it's really about the inner spiritual state. And so much of the Old Law was about physical, but that wasn't the purpose of it, right? There's lots of passages we could look to. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 22, you remember that here Saul had offered sacrifices. And what does Samuel say to Saul? Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offering and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, what does he say? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of the ram. David, in Psalm 51, says, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit in me. This idea of this inner spirituality as opposed to this outward religion. And then in verse 16 and 17, for you do not desire sacrifice, or else I would give it. You do not delight in burnt offerings. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. So I get from this, one of the key verses in Joel is this transition from physical things to spiritual things. And that is found there in chapter 2, verse 13. What's the other... Oh, Dwayne?
Yeah, I think what's the greatest passage from Joel? I'm going to tell you what the New Testament writer calls.
Okay, that's the next one. Yeah, what is it?
The second chapter, verses 28 down through 32, bits and pieces.
Yes. That's exactly right. So the next one, the next key verse is actually 28 and 29. You're right. You could go all the way down to 32 because verse 32 is actually quoted as well. But there, and it shall come to pass thereafter that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams. Your young men shall see visions. And on my maid servants, I will pour out my spirit in those days. Where have we heard that before? Where did we hear that eventually? Acts chapter 2. That's right. Remember, it was after the apostles had received the miraculous gifts of the Spirit, that Peter, in his very first message after the church had been, or as the church is being started, quotes Joel chapter 2 saying, this has been fulfilled in your day. It's really one of two passages quoted in Joel. The other one is, as Dwayne mentioned, verse 32, and that's quoted in Romans 10 and 13, or at least the first part of it is, where it says, whoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved. So I agree. I think that if you think about what's the most significant verses, you probably ought to start with the ones that are quoted in the New Testament. Joel is quoted there in 28 and 29 of chapter 2. All right, what other comments do we have about the book?